Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
I was skeptical about ordering foundation online. I can't even find a match in stores. Then I discovered Il Makiage. Their online quiz found my exact shade in seconds. With Try Before You Buy, you can try your full-size shade at home free for 14 days. But I was obsessed on day one. It's so lightweight and natural, it's literally my skin in a bottle. Take the quiz at ilmakiage.com/quiz. That's ilmakiage.com/quiz.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jeanette Jalil, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 7th of July, these are our main stories. A warning from the World Health Organization that more than 70 countries are at risk of running out of medicines for AIDS patients because of the coronavirus pandemic. UN experts say that diseases that jump from animals to humans will continue to increase if human behavior doesn't change. Also in this podcast, for the first time, Britain imposes independent sanctions against those it considers guilty of corruption and abuse. And
there are billboards displaying these nice rainbow colours. They're quietly promoting these nice rainbow colours using nice words.
A Russian official accuses an ice cream maker of promoting homosexuality by selling a rainbow-coloured product. The start of the International AIDS Conference has been overshadowed by another disease, the coronavirus. There had been hopes that the meeting would be discussing the progress that's been made in treating patients with HIV. But instead, the virtual conference of thousands of HIV specialists and patients is discussing the worrying results of a survey by the World Health Organization. It found that 73 countries are now at risk of running out of medicines needed to treat AIDS patients because of the disruption caused by COVID-19 lockdowns. Winnie Byanyima is the executive director of the UN agency UNAIDS. She told the conference that the coronavirus was threatening to blow all of its work off track.
We are getting reports of facilities being closed, supply chains being disrupted, borders closing, lockdown measures hurting the most vulnerable and stopping them from reaching services. So we've done some studies and we have alerted the world.
The Washington Post's health reporter, Lenny Bernstein, is covering the story.
The supply chain has been affected dramatically. The chain of companies that produce and distribute this, but also everyone is locked down. So it's very difficult for individuals to access their medication. If you are locked down, you are not earning money in some cases, and you can't get to the clinic that habitually is the place where you pick up your treatment medication or your preventive medication.
And what impact is this having on AIDS and HIV patients?
So by one model in South Africa, they're forecasting an additional 500,000 deaths from AIDS and AIDS-related diseases just in 2020 and 2021. There is a great deal of anxiety and trepidation about not being able to access this medication. Some people have said that they have turned to sex work for the money that they need to purchase different medication. All in all, there has been nothing really good that has happened since this pandemic broke out for people living with HIV.
And what makes this especially poignant is that there had actually been significant progress before the pandemic hit.
It really had. In South Africa, they had seen 38% fewer infections. Other parts of the world, they were not doing quite as well. But in general, the number of new infections has been coming down about 2% a year. And there were definitely things that they wanted to highlight at this conference, the progress that they've made largely as a result of these medications.
Lenny Bernstein. The UN is warning that zoonotic diseases, those that jump from animals to humans, are on the rise. A new report says the threat will continue to increase without concerted action. Here's the BBC's Imogen Folkes.
Ebola, West Nile fever, SARS, and of course COVID-19 are all zoonotic diseases. They started in animals and made the jump to humans. But that jump isn't automatic. It is driven, the new report says, by factors such as our increased demand for animal protein, unsustainable agricultural practices, and climate change. The UN Environment Programme suggests we can do better at controlling zoonotic diseases with an interdisciplinary approach that unites human, animal, and environmental health.
Imogen, folks. Britain has often denounced human rights abuses, but it's often been a joint enterprise with allies or the UN. Now, after its departure from the European Union, the UK has announced it's imposed sanctions on dozens of foreign nationals independently of any other country. This was the British Foreign Minister, Dominic Raab, speaking in Parliament on Monday.
Today, this government and this House sends a very clear message on behalf of the British people that those with blood on their hands, the thugs of despots, the henchmen of dictators, will not be free to waltz into this country to buy up property on the King's Road, to do their Christmas shopping in Knightsbridge, or frankly, to siphon dirty money through British banks or other financial institutions.
Our defence and diplomatic correspondent, Jonathan Marcus, told me more about these new sanctions.
Well, of course, this is being trumpeted with great fanfare by the government. It is, in a sense, making a virtue of necessity because Britain is no longer a member of the European Union. All of its sanctions in future are going to have to be enacted unilaterally, whether they're in concert with other countries or not. But this is an interesting step because it's setting a whole new set of sanctions in relation to human rights abuses. Some 47 individuals and two entities have been sanctioned today. 25 of those sanctioned are Russian nationals involved in the death of a lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, who died in jail in Russia in 2009 after uncovering official fraud. Another 20 are Saudi nationals accused of involvement in the murder of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi. And two generals are amongst those named from Myanmar who have been involved in human rights abuses against the Rohingya people.
And what impact are these sanctions likely to have? Because I suppose the big test for Britain will be whether this helps to deter any human rights abuses.
Well, it's unclear what precisely these sanctions will do in themselves. It's not clear what assets, for example, any of these individuals may or may not have in this country. What it does do is it sends a signal of the direction in which the British government intends to go. I think many human rights organisations have welcomed this as a start, but they pushing for consistency. They want to see this as the start of a track along which the British government is going to proceed further. And of course, the problem with sanctions so often is that individual sanctions by individual states are all very well, but unless you're the United States with its extraordinary power, its economic muscle, and its view of the extraterritoriality of its laws, sanctions are a team sport. So Britain's sanctions ultimately are going to only be effective if they work in conjunction with similar sanctions placed by other key nations, other key organisations like the EU and the United Nations.
Jonathan Marcus. Police in Zimbabwe have arrested about a dozen nurses during a protest outside a hospital in the capital, Harare. Health workers are holding demonstrations to demand that they be paid in US dollars because inflation of nearly 800% is eroding their salaries. The coronavirus lockdown put in place to slow the spread of the disease has accelerated political tensions and deepened Zimbabwe's economic crisis. Shingai Anyoka reports from Harare.
After 3 hard months in lockdown, patience is wearing thin. It's nighttime in a poor neighbourhood and whistling protesters are running through the darkened streets. The protests are led by opposition youth members who say this lockdown is being used as a cover for a crackdown. Fadzai Mahere is the Movement for Democratic Change Alliance's spokesperson.
They're being used as an excuse by the government to further shrink the democratic space. We look first at the attempt to curtail by-elections. We look secondly at livelihoods. We also look at the right, for example, to demonstrate. All these aspects are being curtailed.
Recently, three MDC female officials say they were abducted, tortured and sexually assaulted after organizing a protest. They were arrested and charged with lying and violating lockdown regulations and spent 3 weeks in prison before being released on bail. The lockdown has also laid bare the economic cracks.
You won't believe, we used to buy this for $1. Now we are buying them for $74.
In a downtown supermarket, one woman complains about the price of tomatoes. The shelves here are fully stacked with goods, but the customers' trolleys are near empty.
Prices keep rising. I don't know where all this is going or how it will end.
I could afford to buy meat for my children. Now I can't even buy meat for them. It's hard.
Above the checkout counters hangs a portrait of a smiling President Emmerson Mnangagwa. He swept to power with the help of the military. Now, after close to 3 years in office, he looks ever more on shaky ground. His economic policies are failing and the local currency is once again crashing. The government believes it's a victim of economic sabotage and the opposition claims of abductions, part of a regime change agenda. Nick Mangwana is the government spokesperson.
It's a ridiculous play acting that we're dealing with. So yes, they were calculated to besmirch the image of government. Things are not looking good economically, but that every country is suffering because of COVID-19.
The economic crisis that was evident before the coronavirus pandemic is now worsened by the lockdown. In a small grocery store, customer traffic has slowed to a trickle. Its owner, Emmanuel Muchinganu, has been sitting with unsold stock for weeks.
Before the lockdown, things were good. It's now quiet. As you can see, there are no people who are getting in and out buying. They're for no money. Nothing is happening.
A lorry rolls up outside Emmanuel's shop. It's a government roadshow to warn of the dangers of COVID-19. Zimbabwe seems to be winning on that front at least. Cases currently remain below 800, but an increasingly toxic combination of a political and economic fallout may prove more dangerous than the COVID pandemic could ever be.
While in many countries, restaurants, bars and cinemas are reopening, the music industry is still suffering. With many concerts, gigs and music festivals called off because of the COVID-19 pandemic, the livelihoods of thousands of musicians and other self-employed workers are at risk. But one group has an extra problem to contend with, the Irish rock band The Coronas. Siobhan Leahy reports.
Because we sleep all day, we drink all night. We are not wasting our time. We refuse to hide. We're going out tonight.
The Coronas are one of Ireland's biggest bands of the last decade. With 5 albums under their belt and a 6th on the way, their songs have been streamed millions of times and they're no strangers to selling out arenas. But at the end of last year, their viral namesake, the coronavirus, struck. Danny O'Reilly is the frontman for the Coronas.
Initially, we started getting memes and tweets and stuff. And it was a strange thing because we wanted to almost make light of our name. But it sort of didn't really seem appropriate because it was sort of a serious evolving thing. And then when it got to March and every sentence was coronavirus, and the name sort of took a backseat, and whatever effect it would have on us, I think we just had the normal concerns of everyone. So it was an unfortunate name.
Faced with this new dilemma, having to field questions over whether they were a 5G hoax, the band decided it was time to get some advice. So they tweeted Corona Beer, asking simply, what's your plan? Luckily though, for Danny and his bandmates, the publicity might have actually come in quite useful.
By all accounts, our Spotify numbers are doing well, but you know, I'd like to think that that's because we're releasing good music, but who knows?
So their brand has remained intact, but it seems the wider impact of the virus on the music industry has affected the Coronas more than their name.
Just give me a minute.
I should be old enough by now,
They've been forced to delay their sixth album, True Love Waits, until July. They've cancelled festival appearances, postponed tours of the UK, Europe and the US.
There was a few options of possibly looking at drive-in gigs or possibly looking at doing socially distancing performances, but I don't know, we're the type of band where, you know, there's an atmosphere in the room, people are on top of each other, hugging a stranger was actually something that I made part of the set only a year ago, which is ironic in itself because hugging is now a thing that we're not encouraged to do. But in Ireland, there's been rumours that maybe we could get back gigging before the end of the year. You know, we've sort of decided to try and wait it out and hope the gigs come back, yeah.
So, in the meantime, I asked Danny whether the Coronas had considered capitalising on their name.
No, I don't think we're going to come out and try and make a marketing angle, like, you know. Although someone said we should tour with, like, the vaccines and make it a doubleheader or the cure or something like that. And so I like those sort of ideas, but we'll see what happens. You never know. I always talk to other, you know, friends of mine who are in bands and we're talking about how the industry is really messed up at the moment. I always end the conversation with, yeah, but at least you're not named after the virus, you know, and my mates who are in bands always get a bit of a kick out of that. Just give me a minute. Thank you
so much, Shiz. And that report was by Siobhan Lee. You're listening to the Global News podcast on the BBC World Service. Still to come, the value of singing in church choirs in the pandemic.
I think it provides an emotional release, and to know that that's dangerous and that it could actually hurt people is just heartbreaking.
But what is a scientific basis for saying it's dangerous? A Russian official has whipped up a social media storm by claiming that a rainbow-coloured ice cream promotes homosexuality. The head of Russia's official Union of Women said in using rainbow colours, the company that made the ice cream was creating gay propaganda. She made the startling allegation in a video conference with President Vladimir Putin.
There are billboards displaying these nice rainbow colours. They're quietly promoting these nice rainbow colours using nice words. They're advertising an ice cream called Rainbow.
I asked Vitaly Shevchenko from BBC Monitoring how President Putin had responded to this claim.
He said that it's obviously not possible to control all the labels being printed in Russia. But he said if this was indeed a subliminal message, that then it needs to be controlled.
And how has the ice cream maker responded?
The ice cream maker was very quick to distance itself from the whole idea of LGBT rights. A vice president of the company that makes the ice cream said that he has many children himself and he's all for what he termed as traditional values in Russia, which in Russia means a marriage between a man and a woman. And it's important to know that on the 1st of July, Russians held a national vote which effectively outlawed gay marriage.
And these claims about this ice cream product have caused quite an uproar in Russian media.
The response that we in Monitoring have seen is sort of twofold. Of course, lots of people saw the funny side of it. They said that President Putin should ban rainbows in Russia because they send all these subliminal messages and they should involve the defense ministry and use all those guns and bombers just to bomb the rainbows out of existence. But others took a much more serious view of the issue. There's a prominent journalist called Andrei Lashak, and he said, it's saddening that in this day and age, the president of a country as big and important as Russia still sees homophobia as an effective tool to influence the hearts and minds of Russians.
What are wider attitudes like to LGBT rights in Russia?
The latest opinion polls that we've seen, they suggest that Russians are becoming more understanding of gay rights. But it's still, the opinion is still split half and half. For example, one credible opinion survey has suggested that 47% of Russians support equal rights for gay and lesbian people, while 43% are against.
Vitaly Chevchenko. The US authorities have transferred Ghislaine Maxwell, a close associate of the convicted paedophile Jeffrey Epstein, to a prison in New York. Ghislaine Maxwell has previously denied any involvement in or knowledge of Mr. Epstein's alleged sexual misconduct. Neda Torfik reports.
A spokesperson from the Federal Bureau of Prisons confirmed that Ghislaine Maxwell is in custody at the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn. She was arrested last Thursday in New Hampshire, where she had been hiding out since December on a 60-hectare estate in the mountains called Tucked Away. Prosecutors and Ms. Maxwell's defense lawyer have asked a judge to schedule a court appearance for a bail hearing in Manhattan for Friday. The British socialite and close associate of Jeffrey Epstein is awaiting trial on 4 criminal counts related to procuring and transporting minors for illegal sex acts between 1994 and 1997 and 2 counts of perjury.
Neda Tofik. In Israel, bars, clubs, public halls and gyms have been ordered to close their doors once again after a sharp rise in coronavirus infections there. Synagogues are also being limited to a maximum of 19 people inside at any one time. The Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, warned the situation was so serious a full lockdown could be imposed again. The average number of cases is now around 1,000 a day after sinking to double figures in May. Our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher, told me what may have caused cases to rise again.
Lots of people probably saw the pictures of crowded beaches, the restaurants, the bars all open again. So now there's criticism of the government for having opened everything up too early, and their reaction has been to close a lot of places down again. Numbers of public gatherings are being cut right down to the bone again. That's on buses, that's in restaurants, that's for religious worship as well. So it's a big step back. I mean, the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, was saying today that it's like one step away from lockdown. I mean, it certainly isn't as stringent as it was 2 or 3 months ago, but it's moving towards that way. And the fear, the concern has been raised on an almost daily basis over the last 2 or 3 weeks over the situation.
And the Palestinian authorities in the West Bank are very concerned about the situation there as well.
I mean, very similar. I mean, on a much lower level, because obviously the population is much smaller, but they've seen a rise as well. They went into lockdown for 5 days, just a couple of days ago. Again, and they've just called actually this afternoon on Israel to close the borders so that there won't be any chance of infection between the two areas. I mean, it's a sign of how seriously both sides are taking this outbreak. And there was much earlier in the outbreak, I think, quite a strong sense in the West Bank, in the Palestinian territories, that the problem was coming from Israel. Obviously, the hostility is always there, and there's a sense that the Israelis are the ones who have it worse, and they're the ones who are likely to bring it to us. I don't think there's much talk of that now. I think the situation and the seriousness of it is just making both the Palestinian authorities and the Israeli government just feel that they could be facing a second wave that could be worse than the first.
And what about the situation in Gaza?
That's a strange one in a way, because naturally at the start of the pandemic, places like Gaza, which obviously are run down, poor, health facilities not great, and very, very packed, so things like social distancing are hard, hasn't had reported anything like the outbreaks we've seen in Israel and in the West Bank. Now, that may be down to the fact that Gaza is so sealed off, something, of course, which people in Gaza complain quite rightly about much of the time, may in this case have helped them, that they're not having people come in and out. So there haven't been the infections brought in. And at the moment, I think they haven't even reached double figures in the number of deaths.
Sebastian Usher. Communal singing at church services has been banned in the UK and restricted in Germany and the Netherlands because of the coronavirus pandemic. How, though, will choirs survive? And what is the scientific basis for choir singing being especially dangerous? Our arts correspondent, David Solito, reports from the southern English cathedral city of Wales.
I just love the sound we make when we're together.
Welcome to Bebbington's Creative Community Choir. They were allowing me to sit in on rehearsals, which are, of course, now taking place on Zoom.
It isn't the same as being in the room together, obviously.
What I miss is actually meeting up with people, being able to share things. When you're singing on your own, you do feel very isolated.
Zoom is not really a good choral solution. So what's the route map to restore singing? It was this thought that took me to meet the choral community of Wells Cathedral. A few housemates have been singing in gardens, but other than that, there's been silence.
It breaks my heart, to be honest. I'm Emily Risden, and I sing in the Schola Cantorum, which is the ladies' choir at the cathedral.
Do you miss the singing?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it provides an emotional release, and to know that that's dangerous and that it could actually hurt people is just heartbreaking. I feel like there's been a lot of research put into working out how pubs and cafes and restaurants can be safe for people, and yet the arts just don't seem to be receiving the same treatment.
Discussions about restoring singing have been taking place. Amongst the proposals being discussed, 3 metre gaps between singers and restricting the number of singers to 6.
That's 3. I need to walk towards.
So what would a socially distanced choir sound like?
So this is the last one, 3 metres again?
To be extra safe, we did it outside the cathedral, and I stood well back. It sounded beautiful to me, but the singers...
3 metres apart. Did it work for you?
Well...
That's a no, isn't it?
I'm going to say it's going to be very difficult.
There has to be some science. There has to be something concrete to actually justify the decision to ban singing.
Should it be 1 metre, 2 metre, 3 metres, 4 metres? Should there be a limit on how many singers there are? It's all down to what's coming out of the mouths other than the music. And the science behind that is a bit sketchy.
There are a number of research studies that have been done around the world, but it's very difficult to do research in this area because the quantities of aerosol and droplets that you're talking about are really very small and very difficult to measure and require very specialist kit.
Which is why Declan Costello, a consultant who specialises in treating the singing voice, has been encouraging some real science.
Singing has been singled out as being a dangerous, quote-unquote, thing to do, really without any evidence or research to back that up. There are probably more consonants involved in speaking than in singing, and hence there might be more droplets in speaking and more aerosol in singing. We just don't know.
And back in Wells with our impromptu performance, it was a reminder of just how silent these months have been. The hope is the go-ahead will be given soon for the research to begin, which it's hoped will open up a pathway to once again allow us to sing together.
And that report was by David Siletto. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Janat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
As the world's largest network of remote professionals, we're here to help. Upwork is giving $1 million in talent grants to projects that counter the ongoing impacts of COVID-19. By connecting existing teams with independent experts in tech, creative, and operations to help save lives, to support communities, and rebuild the economy. Go to upwork.com/worktogether to learn more.